The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Well, welcome to a special City Bible Forum today. We're going to talk about leading the Aussie way. And we have two men here who've had great experience in leading Aussies in one form or another. I'm sure many of you will know John Anderson. In terms of leading Australians, John was the Deputy Prime Minister from mid-99 to mid-2005, those 6 years. And he's still busy leading people in the not-for-profit sector and so on, and in his spare time running the farm near Gunnedah. Great to have you with us, John. And Andrew Scipione is the New South Wales Police Commissioner. So, gentlemen, thank you for being with us.
Thanks, sir.
There'll be an SMS number on the screen behind us. If you'd like to SMS through questions, some of them will get up. They'll come through to the screen here. I'll do my best. Now, in terms of leading the Aussie way, what I wanted to ask, mentioning yesterday, last week I was in Martin Place handing out leaflets, actually advertising this meeting, and our federal foreign minister went past. Not in a motorcade, not with police outriders, not with a siren, but Bob Carr walked up Martin Place on his own carrying a backpack. And somebody said, "Hey, there's Bob." And everyone went, "Uh-huh," and Bob kept walking. Now, in other countries, motorcades, is there something different or unusual about leading Aussies, different or unusual in the way that we think about authority?
Wow. Oh, look, I mean, the beautiful story that comes from what you've just described, Al, is the fact that we live in Australia. This is a unique country. This is not necessarily representative of what security environments look like around the world. You're right, you couldn't do that in the US. There would have been outriders, there would have been road closures, rolling road closures with outriders, the full nine yards. The fact that I could come down here, make my way down here, that I'm not carrying a protection detachment, I'm not in any way being supported, there is no one outside sort of covering my back, it just goes to the heart of why we live in this, the very best country in the world. This is a different place. I think we don't have the same levels of violence, we don't have the same contrasting views within community where people display their position on the end of a gun, like we see in America so often with so much happening in that space. This is a unique part of the world where I think we've been blessed, and you know, the notion of this being the great Southland of the Holy Spirit rings true in so many ways, and that's but one.
Okay. Are there a great place to live? And I'm sure you wouldn't get an argument here. Is it a great place to be a leader? Are we, you know, you might love Aussies, but is it like herding cats or cattle?
I think Australians look for authenticity. They hate people who put on front. That's the sort of upside. Jack's as good as his master. I think it's a great principle. It reflects that Christian worldview that really is at the heart of our cultural heritage and background. That says that all people matter, all people have dignity. The downside can be that we can lop the tall poppies a little bit too much. And there is a tendency now in this country, in fact I'll be blunt, far too much of a tendency, for the gatekeepers to the public debate, if you know what I sort of mean by that, to, if you like, make it very tough for reasonable people who want to put their ideas on the table. You get the idea sometimes that if you put something out there that you think should be debated, no matter how reasonable you are about it, if the gatekeepers to the public debate don't like it, they'll demonise you. And I often have Aussies say, "I'd like to contribute to this debate, but I'm just not, I'm afraid to." So you can carry it too far. You're right about this wonderful security environment, though, Andrew, and I must say, you know, sincerely, thanks to people like you and those that you lead, we owe you a great debt in your presence. The Bobby on the beat, which is the Australian approach to policing by and large, is a tremendous thing. In terms of stories, too, very briefly, I did many stints as acting PM. It was the only time I had bodyguards. The rest of the time, you were free to shoot me. So the Prime Minister...
and John, probably not by choice. It would have been almost a protocol issue that you had bodyguards as opposed to any emerging threat.
That's a very reassuring thought. And particularly in view of what I'm about to say, because according to the media, I did 43 stints as acting Prime Minister. Now, that should frighten you, but I did. I used to notice, you see, that whenever the PM, as he used to say, would arrive, when he left, he'd say, I'd leave the keys on your desk. He'd ring when he got back and say, I'll pick the keys up this afternoon or whatever. But, you know, I'd be at a meeting like this. There'd be the bodyguards in the audience. They'd get up and walk out, and I'd know that the Prime Minister's wheels had touched down and it was all right for you to have a go at me. But on a serious note, just on this, and I don't want to labour it, but, you know, taxi drivers are tremendous at recognising you. And I got one the other day that didn't, and I was going from the North Shore out to the airport. We got to the bridge, and I'm dozing off because I was tired, thinking, thank heavens, this one doesn't want to engage me in the conversation. Now I've offended the taxi drivers, but anyway. When all of a sudden he was a big, powerfully built black man, and he just quietly said, I'm so glad I came to this country. And I said, well, why is that? He did recognise me. He said, because I wouldn't be driving the former Deputy Prime Minister of Australia, of my country, to the airport in a taxi. He'd be in a black limo bought with squandered aid dollars with some goons riding in a jeep with machine guns behind. It was an interesting thing for him to say, and that's exactly what he said. Okay. I won't say where he was from.
But it's easy to take all of this for granted, isn't it? But there was a fairly, how can I put it, fairly high criminal ratio when the nation of Australia began. Mm. is it difficult leading, policing Australians? That you asked where we often have a negative attitude to authority. Is that true? Is it difficult to lead us?
No, I don't think so. I think by and large we all want good leaders. I want to have a very healthy leader in charge of my government, even though I'm in a position of authority. At the end of the day, Australians are like everyone else. We all crave for somebody that we can trust, that we can believe in, that we believe is competent and capable and passionate about the things that matter. And that's what leadership's about, by and large, in my sphere of influence as well. People actually want to have some belief in my role. And it's not just community, it's those that work for me. You know, the organisation's 20,000 people strong, the New South Wales Police Force. And they don't like to have scandal around their leaders. They don't like to have a sense of disbelief or an understanding that what comes from the mouth of a commissioner may be lies, it may be truth, but it may not be. They actually want to believe. They want somebody to lead them. And I think that's where we are. And I think that there is a fantastic biblical experience that we all look to. We all look to Christ, you know, and I often reflect. People say, what's the best management book you've ever read, or what's your management book you're reading now? And I'll often say, well, the most important management book I've ever had has been the Bible that sits by my bed that I get a chance to read every day, every night, because every management manual that's ever been written has been modelled on that when it comes back to the way we lead, the servant leadership model. And so I think it sits well with us. Certainly people want leadership, they want strong leaders, and I think Australians respond appropriately. I mean, we can send a message out and we by and large get the response that we need, where people really understand the importance of community.
Okay, let me pick up one of those threads there. You've mentioned the Bible. What is it that you... I mean, I know you're preaching to the choir here, okay, with City Bible Forum, but what is it that you learn from the Bible? What are the specifics there? What is it that you take, and John the same, what is it that you would take out of the Bible as it's written and take to work leading 20,000 people or leading a nation?
From my perspective, in terms of when I went through all of my education, my training, and I can recall sitting in a university in Sydney, not too far away from here, as a reasonably junior, mid-level leader within the organisation, probably at the time in charge of 150 or so people, predominantly men, I had to sit down and think to myself, what do I use as my leadership model? What is my leadership style? And for the first time, I actually had to make a decision in terms of what I would use as the model, because I needed some guidance. And everything that I'd ever learnt, bearing in mind I didn't make a decision to become a Christian until I was a 14-year-old boy. Didn't come from a church family, so I had no exposure to Bible at all. But it became very apparent very early on that the best model that I could take when I was leading either my family, my football team, or in fact those that worked for me, was a servant leadership model. And that's what I took from the Bible, the fact that Jesus modelled leadership in the very best way, and he came to serve, not to be served.
Now, to be a servant, though, or John? Yeah.
No, you're right.
I was going to ask, you're going to be a servant, mm-hmm. but in your job, you've got to kick back sides as well.
Absolutely.
So how do you be a servant while you're kicking someone's backside?
Metaphorically speaking. That's a great question. That same manual that I talked about, mm-hmm. that modern management leadership manual that goes back so many years, called the Bible, there was one particular verse in there coming out of Micah 6, that talked mm-hmm. about in everything you do, you know, act justly, love mercy, and walk humbly. And so in my life, I had to work through, well, how does that apply to me as a cop? And it was pretty, put it into cop speak, as they say. And I took that and used that to this day. The notion of, act justly, it's do the right thing in everything you do. The notion of loving mercy didn't mean you needed to be weak. It meant give people a fair go. And then, of course, to finish, to walk humbly, don't get a big head. Cops often get that because we've got a lot of authority and power. Don't go there. It's not a good place to be. So to do the right thing, to walk and not get the big head, and then to give people a fair go in my job, the kicking of the backsides that you're talking about is in that give people a fair go, because some people yep. earn and deserve a sore backside. Mm-hmm. And so to walk away from that responsibility in itself would be a betrayal to what it is I actually thought was what God was telling me through his word in the way I should act as a man and as a leader.
But insisting on justice occasionally is a vitally important part
Absolutely.
Of love. There can be no love if there's no justice. There has to be a valuing of the victim of crime. But my reading this morning was... you'll reap what you sow, so sow bountifully, which is very challenging for me. You see, I'm from a slightly different tradition from you. I'm Scottish by background. I'm a Presbyterian. And I don't like being generous. That's why I was so good on the Expenditure Review Committee in Canberra.
I noticed you got some very long pockets in those pants.
You haven't asked me yet for a cup of coffee. That's when you'll really find out. But, you know, for me on this leadership issue, what did the Bible bring? An answer to the conundrum of human life. You know, Kim Beazley gave a brilliant speech once in the Parliament when he talked about the ending of the Second World War 60 years before, the 60th anniversary, and he said something to the effect of, you know, we saw in that terrible conflict, didn't we, the great conundrum that needs great answers. We saw the utter depravity that people are capable of, contrasted with the extraordinary nobility that we see at the other extreme. People laying down their lives for their loved ones, for their ideals, for their freedoms, for their children. And it wasn't any different on the day he read that, you know, one of your officers was being decorated, opposite numbers or whatever in Victoria, mm-hmm. for saving a family from a fire. Turn over the page, young man's gone to jail for a very long period of time for dropping his de facto's child in a tub of boiling water because he couldn't put up with the screaming anymore. Nothing's changed. It's in the Bible that you find the answer to the dilemma. Created to be good in relationship with the King of the universe, flawed by our own selfishness.
That's it.
But the great thing is, there's a way back. And I found in public life, because you're confronted with it all the time. You really were. You know, one of the things that's interesting, you know, used cars salesmen and politicians sometimes have an image problem. And I once said to a used car salesman, how do you cope with sometimes being the butt of some pretty cruel and pointed remarks about your integrity? Oh, he said, I just remind myself, about the people who come in with a little old car that's only been driven to church by granny on Sundays, and it's a complete and utter wreck because it's been cut and shut and sort of put back together, having been driven around Australia and across the Gibber Desert. And sometimes I'd see constituents who'd tell me the most outrageous porkies. And then I wasn't a leader because I couldn't resolve their problem. And you'd see the other extreme. We have both, don't we? The stamp of the Almighty. That's where the dignity and the admirable qualities come from. Destroyed by our own. The Garden of Eden story. We've moved the Almighty out of his chair at the centre of our universe and put ourselves into it. And it hasn't worked very well.
Yeah, let me ask you a question then. I'll pick up a few from here. What's the essence then of leadership? What is it that someone's a leader when they can what? If you're looking for the next generation of leaders, the young ones who are coming through, what are you looking for?
Well, I think you can define leadership, for good or for ill, very loosely as having the capacity to form a vision. You can see what needs to be done, whether it's, you know, the local football team or heading up the police force or being a prime minister in a time of war. You have to have the ability to explain it to others, and then you have to have about you the personal qualities of integrity, of trustworthiness, of compassion and what have you, to inspire others to work with you to achieve that vision. But that's a rough template for leadership, but can be used for good or ill. I mean, an Adolf Hitler had a vision, might have been horrific, but he had one, and he was able to convey enough of it to achieve the third objective, inspire people to work with him to make it happen. Andrew's already talking about the other model, at the other end of the extreme. You ask kids this in a sort of quiz show in a classroom. Often used to do that. The kids would come to Canberra. You'd meet with them, you know, from their school groups, and you'd just hope you got to them before they got to question time. And they'd get it. You'd say, what's the opposite model? It's quite interesting, that comment that Andrew made. We're looking for a decent model, and we understand it, many of us intuitively, that it's Christ. They'd get it, the servant model fit, lying, you know, making the sacrifices for others.
At the heart of that servant idea, and Andrew talked about being humble, in your jobs you'd be told pretty often that you're important and treated like you're important. Has there ever been a temptation to start thinking that you're important? How do you, hypothetically, if that happened, how would you try and keep that in control?
Oh, it's the third leg of my Micah example there. You know, don't get a big head. Don't fool yourself. Do not fool yourself. We were talking about it, John, you and I, just before we went and had a sandwich. Exactly that. You know, don't believe your own PR, because invariably it's wrong. Now, look, yep. It's an important point. And that's where you see so many people come undone in leadership.
Yeah.
Because they seem to be too large for their own life.
Start believing in their own publicity, life. You mean.
It's incredibly important.
And you'll see them unravel.
Men particularly.
Yeah.
I don't know why. You girls are better at it, I think, than we men, but pride is a heck of a problem. And C.S. Lewis said, you know, really it is the great problem. It's self-centeredness. And it's the thing that prevents us from looking, when we think we're at the top of the pile, looking up and seeing God, and makes us look down on others, and shatters the essential thing for which we were created, being in relationship. That's what it does.
And it's in that vein that often the higher you go in an organisation or in a government or in any setting at all, the quicker you are to forget that it's not all about you. I mean, I talk about servant leadership. When I go to a community meeting, I will make it my business to say a couple of things. First and foremost, I lead an organisation on behalf of you. The New South Wales Police Force is not something that I own. You do. In fact, the New South Wales Police men and women and those that work alongside them in civilian positions own me, just like you own me. And when you get an understanding of where you belong and where you fit in, then things are much simpler. The reality is we are there to serve. If we weren't there to serve you as a community, what would we be here for? The notion of me owning anything in this regard is wrong. I'm but a steward. I'll have it for a very short period and I'll hand the baton over. But at the end of the day, what will never change is those that actually own the organisation, and that's you. And so it's important that as leaders, we really understand where we fit and that we don't get fooled by anything other than reality into believing that we are more important than we are, because it's not all about us.
Well, we talked about vision and we talked about the kind of the personal aspects of integrity and so on. Can I ask you a personal question? And it'll just be between us and the internet,
sure.
Your answer.
Sure. Understand that.
If I could ask Andrew first. Andrew, every time I hear in the paper the sad news that someone in this very large police force has been killed in some way by accident or and so on, in the line of duty, you're there. Yeah. And you're there with family and so on. I remember you going to Tamworth a little while ago and so on. Mm. How do you cope with that? Yeah. How often does it happen, and how do you... You've been doing... You've commissioned now for six, seven years.
Yeah, that's right. Look, it happens too often. Every time I walk into this building, in fact, into this precinct, I remember just next door, we buried a young fellow who... Will Cruz. He was shot dead in a car park at Bankstown late one night. It happens far too often. You talked about Tamworth being... David Rickson, a highway patrol officer, shot dead, simply doing his job, gunned down, and yet displaying the heroism that we expect from our police in having, being able to return fire, shoot the offender, holster his gun, withdraw his handcuffs, handcuff the offender to himself, and then fall down and collapse dead. Or Bryson Anderson, as recently as last December, where, again, a wonderful man that's given his life in service, unfortunately taken in his prime, and we as an organisation, we grieve alongside his natural family, because we are family. How does it feel? It feels dreadful. There is no worse task than being there with a widow or a grieving daughter or son, trying to make some sense out of something that, where there is no sense, where there's been a terrible wrong done, and yet trying to hold that together. Do you want to be there? That is the last place I would like to be. Do I have anywhere else I can be? Nowhere on earth. Nowhere on earth should I be, but right there grieving. And I can recall getting to the hospital where Bryson was when he was killed, getting there before his wife Donna and the children, and I felt happy. You would say, why would you feel happy? I said, I felt happy because I was there in a position to meet them, to greet them, and then to start working with them at their terrible time. And so, it does take its toll, and an organisation like mine is but a big family. It's a big blue family. We grieve together. That will always be the case. One lost officer is one too many, but unfortunately on my watch I've had three that have been killed, but many others that have died during the course of their duties, which again is terrible, but having said that, nothing as traumatic as having lost your life in the course of an operation. So it's hard stuff.
And do you put that down as... Is that just the cost of leadership?
It is. It is. You know, if I had to look at myself in the mirror very, very early on and say, if you don't want to have to do that, then go and get another job. Hmm. You know, to be a leader, to be a police officer is a tough gig. To be a leader in a police force is pretty tough. And, you know, if I won't offend the cab drivers, but if I want an easier job than being a commissioner of police, go and get a job driving a cab. So you pick up the former Prime Minister, Deputy Prime Minister. But seriously, that goes with the contract.
Okay. John, I wonder if you... Can I ask you, of those 40-odd times that you were acting Prime Minister, one of those was on the 10th and 11th of September 2001. In terms of the cost of leadership, can you take us through that night? John Howard's in the USA, your phone rings...
It was a pretty dreadful week because ANSAT failed that week. Remember ANSAT? Mm-hmm. We all thought of it as an Australian airline. Can I just remember it was actually a New Zealand airline? It was owned by Air New Zealand. Any New Zealanders here? I hate to offend you. There is one. Well, I don't mean to be offensive, and I know you won't go home. But I just remind the Australian... Anyway, I'd been up right through Sunday night and Monday night sort of working through all of that, and then this happened. And it's one of those moments when you just wish you weren't on the bridge, but you know you can't do what the Greek ship captain did, you know? You've got to stay there. So you're thinking, I wish I was just back on the farm, wish I'd never got involved in this, but I am. And I remember thinking, quite rationally, at the time... with all of us coming at me, what does it mean? Will there be more attacks? The advice was that there could well be. Such counter-terrorism arrangements as we had in place at that time were tripped, even to the extent that we had a Qantas flight headed to the west coast of America. It was turned back. Somebody on board spotted somebody playing a suspicious-looking computer game. It was reported to the captain, who reported it back here. So we diverted the plane from Sydney to Brisbane. But I remember getting on my hands and knees and saying, well, the only thing I can do here is say, Lord, my first responsibility is to you, my second is to the Australian people, and I don't rate in this equation, so give me what I need, please, to take the best possible counsel, not to miss anything, lest on my watch someone dies, or lots of people die, and it's a pretty heavy feeling. So but I did know, I have to say, the peace of the Almighty at that time. And you know something, for all of the cynicism about public religion today, I suspect that most Australians would be relieved that I sought higher counsel on that occasion. I hope they were, or would have been, but I think that was the right thing to do.
Now, you must, or I'm assuming, at different times in a high-level leadership job, you must get to the point where you're not sure what to do, you've got a crisis.
Oh, that was the time. We didn't know what to do. We're taking the best advice from everyone. No one knows for certainty who's done this, where it might appear next. You don't know. You don't know. So you take the best advice you can, and then you have to appear calm and purposeful. And I knew that one of the most important aspects of my job was actually, don't misinterpret this word, please, but the showmanship of the television performance appearances the next morning. It was over to me to appear calm and collected and reassuring. And I had tremendous support, I have to say. This country produces, for all of our sometimes, jocular attitude, some remarkable public servants. And the people in this country, in the wake of that, and the AFP, and Australian Federal Police, your colleagues, DSD, the Defence Forces, the ASIO, ASIS, all of them, I have to say they stepped up in a way that would have made you immensely proud had you known more of how they put any of their own personal considerations aside at that time.
So there are times when there's emotional turmoil, you don't know what you're doing, you don't know exactly what to do or what's going on. What does a leader have to do then?
Well, I would say first and foremost, remember he's not top of the pile. There is a greater authority, mm-hmm. and he ultimately will determine what happens. I don't think you can visit more misery on your fellow man than pretending that you don't need to refer to an external reference points, if you know what I mean by that. Look at the 20th century, the agony visited on people who thought mankind's at the top of the pile and we are not accountable in any way to a higher moral code, let alone a God. So I think I would say that that's the first thing to keep in mind. The second thing to keep in mind is that's where servant leadership comes out. If you're just about saving your own skin, the chances are that you'll make an inferior set of choices.
Mm. Can I ask a question then about a culture? As I read about leadership and look around and so on, people generally say any group becomes like its leader, whether that be an organisation, a football club, a church, whatever it is. Andrew, how do you try and influence the culture of 20,000 people?
Well, look, you know, I mean, the notion of a group becoming like the leader, I'm not sure that I would be a full adherent to that mm-hmm. view, but I certainly know that you can influence, and the reality is what I focus on gets done. That's just the reality. But having said that, I'm mindful that you know, I serve 20,000 that work alongside me, for me. And at the end of the day, they're like anyone else looking for leadership. They want to know what to do, when to do it, how to do it. They're certainly looking to me for some good decision making. The notion of you talked a bit earlier about in terms of leadership, when you go through those tough times, how do you know that this is all going to work out? What is it you can draw down on? In my experience, this notion of leadership, and it goes to what John talked about. We've all got a boss. Everyone in this life has got a boss. It just depends where yours is. And ours might be a higher calling, but at the end of the day, regardless, there is a boss in my life, and certainly I, like John, go looking for higher counsel regularly, not just once or twice a day, but regularly. Having said that, you know, the notion of leadership is important to understand, and bad things happen to leaders because bad things happen to communities, and if you're a community leader, guess what? You're meant to deal with it. And it's not necessarily what happens to you as a leader that determines the outcome. It's what you do in response. So you need to have a very clear understanding of what it is that you're going to do. Then you need to be confident enough to deliver it, and then be it, understandably, you need to be accountable for what you've done. And if you can do that, and if you can be reassured, like I'm sure you were on that day of 9/11, that what you were doing was the right thing to do based on all of the counsel that you sought and then the decision that you made to put your feet firmly down as a foundation and stand there and say, this is where we are going, people, and this is why we're doing it. In itself, it's wonderfully relieving to know that I've got that sort of logistical support, or my back's covered through an Almighty who cares about me, who knows what I'm going through, and more importantly, has all of the answers when I have often none.
Andrew can't say it because he's a genuinely humble man. And if this swells his head, go and read C.S. Lewis, where he says the great thing to pursue is modesty, and just when you think you're making progress, you know you're not. He, of course, is a superb example. So it'll have an influence on those around him. He's a superb example. And his example should, when we see it, that sort of example should make us question, what makes him different? What makes for those admirable qualities? And I'd say that is a pointer to the things that really shape a culture. Because what really shapes a culture is what people believe and hold in common as dear, and then the values and the behaviour and the ethics that are driven by those values out of that belief system. And that's why the West is changing very rapidly there. I would put it to you that we need to rethink, is this age of belief in self. I think that's the defining thing now, isn't it? It's all about me. You know, the advertising industry can tell you what you think, how Australians think. And I think that's a concern, because I don't think it's in the end sustainable. If it's all about me, what about the bloke sitting next to me? Why shouldn't he think it's all about him? And you know, Australians, I think they are looking for good, authentic leadership. But can I just say to sort of bastardise C.S. Lewis, we mock honour and wonder why there are traitors in our midst. As a culture, we need to say more to our young people about thinking beyond themselves. If we teach them it's only about them, look after number one, you're it, you can't then be surprised when in a democratic system, the leaders that are thrown up by democracy think it's all about them as well. Often we see in our leaders qualities we don't like without recognising that in fact they're the very qualities that we've instilled in our children by sins of omission or commission.
Do you think if the police commissioner can influence 20,000 people, is it possible for politicians, for those who lead our nation, to actually influence our nation as well? Or is that just too big a task?
Look,
apolitical.
Look, I think only minimally and for short term. I mean, the greatest leader in England in the 20th century, we'd all agree, I think, was probably Winston Churchill. Did he really change Britain? He himself, by the mid-60s, was agonising over whether Britain had a future because he didn't recognise the qualities in the nation, and yet he'd been a massively influential leader. They can, but I suspect it's only in limited ways. I really do think. Actually, to be really honest, I think in our own culture, the flavour of the culture, the nature of the culture, derived from its Christian heritage, far more than from any one individual. There are massive figures who worked through that to influence the culture, but I think the impact of any one man or woman is quite limited.
So if we take back, we've just got a couple of minutes left, if we go back to Andrew's opening comment about just how safe and well off we are here and so on, you'd look back to what kind of foundations, where that's come from? You're saying it's from John or Andrew?
For me, let me just put it before you. I don't want to sound like an old-fashioned, you know, so-and-so just wants to look to the past. But I actually believe that some things are timeless and eternal. I do believe there is an infinitely powerful, loving creator who cares so much that he will insist on justice. I do think we can be reconciled to him. I do think we should take seriously the two great commandments, that the most influential man who ever walked the surface of the earth, plainly, was Christ. He said the two great things are to love God with all your heart and mind. Mind, don't forget that one. Engage our minds. Christianity is not a case of intellectual suicide. I think Tim Keller had it right. It's intellectually credible and existentially satisfying. I found that. I think Andrew has found that. You believe that? Many of you do. If you don't, then I would say please explore it. I think the alternatives are very empty. I really do. And, you know, that second command of love your neighbour, can I tell you something? I I am a passionate believer in parliamentary democracy and in the freedoms of the West. I'm not saying we've got it all right. There have been terrible mistakes, and there are many things today we still need to fix, but I passionately believe that is in a fallen world, as Churchill put it, it's better than all of the alternatives. And I know there's some young people here today. 40% of young Australians feel unwedded to democracy. Well, we've got to fix it. But it's not the system that's broken, it's what we're doing with it. Because what's at the heart of the model is this beautiful idea that every individual matters. Because of the Second Commandment, because of the story of the Good Samaritan and its influence on our culture. And the radical point at which Christianity, which is radical, intersects with public policy is this idea that the king must respect the serf as much as the serf has to respect the king. As Australians might say, Jack's as good as his master. No one should lord it over the other. Before the Almighty, none of us have anything to lord over anybody. And yet before the Almighty, we all matter.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, our time has gone. I wonder actually if you'd thank John and Andrew for being with us. Thank you.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.